afternoon, everyone. It is a pleasure to welcome you all, and especially Professor Laurel Fletcher, at our lunchtime talk today. Professor Fletcher comes from Berkeley, where she is the director of the International Human Rights Law Clinic and also the Miller Institute for Global Challenges and the Law. She has advocated on behalf of victims before international criminal courts. She has submitted numerous reports in the field of human rights and also conducted empirical studies in the area. And today she is going to address us on the very interesting topic of universities and how they deal with their past histories. Before I pass on the floor to Professor Fletcher, I also want to offer our special thanks to Cambridge University Press for their support for this event. And now on to you and your talk.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here and to be back here at the center. So my talk today is about paintings by the Colombian artist Fernando Botero that hang at my law school, Berkeley Law. And so the questions that they prompt is, what are these paintings doing here? What do they tell us, not just about what they depict, but what do they tell us about who we as lawyers and lawyers in training are, and how we should use our power to shape the world? But I want to start today by talking about the photos that inspired the paintings. So in April 2004, this is about 2.5 years into the U.S. declared war on terror, photos of U.S. soldiers abusing prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison facility in Iraq became public and created an international scandal that made this image here an icon of that abuse. The photos, some of which are shown here, may be familiar to many of you. Though the impact of these images sent international shockwaves because the pictures undermine the Bush administration's claim that the United States was prosecuting the war on terror consistent with American values and rule of law. And it brought intense scrutiny to the lawyers who were held in the public imaginary responsible for this state of affairs. Now, I'm sure that everyone here is familiar with those memos, which are called the torture memos. That first memo was leaked, so it is commonly known as the torture memo, but it was one in a series. It was leaked a few weeks after the 60 Minute report. It was leaked in 2004. It was written 2 years earlier, and it authorized so-called enhanced interrogation techniques which could be used on suspected terrorists held by the CIA in detention. Now, I'm not going to rehearse here the legal reasoning of the memo or its resounding denunciations, but I'm happy to do so in Q&A. But I do think it's important to remind us of the human toll that the US detention and interrogation program took. We now know that over 100 detainees were held as part of the CIA program, and the techniques in the memo spread throughout the military operations. So you probably remember that the first subject of these new techniques was an Al-Qaeda operative, Abu Zubaydah. He's famous or infamous, not just for his role, but more for the abuse that he suffered by the CIA. Over the course of 17 days, he was waterboarded, and I quote from the Senate report, 2 to 4 times a day, with multiple iterations of the water cycling during each application, meaning the application of the waterboard, which is a simulated drowning. The Senate investigation into the program confirms that CIA detainees were subject to techniques that were outlined in the torture memo, as well as other abuses that were not specifically authorized in them. The detainees were held in conditions that were designed to break their spirits and so that they would cooperate and give up information. The chief of interrogations at the CIA's lead facility favorably compared the environment that they had created to dungeons. What were those conditions? Detainees were held in total darkness, shackled to the walls, with a bucket to use for their human waste. Now, because of the torture memos, instead of facing criminal charges for any of this, legal approval for the program meant that those involved would be immunized from sanction. So now it's widely acknowledged that the approved techniques throughout this period permitted torture and violated international law. But at the time, there was considerable debate on this point. And I argue that the lack of a definitive legal judgment about the program continues to reverberate and complicate what meaning we can take from this period. So in some sense, what my project is a case study about how one legal community, Berkeley Law, is linked to the torture program and how it's grappled with whether and how it should acknowledge this history. So some of these questions: what do we do when the past is still with us? How does this complicate our sense of what is an appropriate or inappropriate way to remember? And at a time when many institutions are taking down symbols of their shameful past, Mark Drummel talked about that in his talk here a few weeks ago, do they nevertheless have a moral duty to remember? So these are the questions that I'm interested in. Okay, so let's begin. So how is Berkeley linked to the torture memos? The principal author of the torture memo of 2002 was then Assistant Attorney General John Yoo, and he's a member of the Berkeley Law faculty. Now, it's important to note that while the abuses to which the Abu Ghraib prisoners were subjected occurred outside of interrogation, in other words, they weren't under interrogation, those weren't techniques that Yoo and others had approved. Nevertheless, critics in and outside the administration attributed the abuse in the facility to the environment that the torture memos, with their loosened standards of treatment, had created. So in the public imagination, Abu Ghraib became the symbol of the abuses that were linked with detention and interrogation, and Professor Yoo became the human face of the lawyer who had authorized it. Now, as you can see from his bio here, Professor Yoo was a tenured member of the Berkeley faculty before he took leave to go and work in the administration. So at the time the scandal broke, he had just resumed his position at Berkeley Law. We often get questions, why did you hire him? What were you thinking? And it's important to remember, he was tenured before and entitled to return. Okay, there was immediate public uproar over Professor Yoo after the Abu Ghraib scandal, outside the law school and inside the law school. And so students protested at graduation that year and in subsequent years. And there have been public demonstrations around the campus against Professor Yoo. Sort of each time there were further disclosures about the detention and interrogation program, there would be repeated demonstrations. And along with this were repeated demands that the university sanction or fire Professor Yoo. And so you have to sort of imagine you're walking around, going to class, and there are people in orange suits, and they have a simulated cage where Guantanamo detainees were held, and so all of this is going on as people are kind of coming and going to class. So it was sort of coming and going as a constant change in our environment. Now, the dean of the law school at the time was Christopher Edley, and he resisted these demands that for sanctioning Professor Yoo for years. And in fact, didn't even issue any public statements for the first 4 years. It was only in 2008 that he issued a statement on the topic. And what he did there is interesting. He acknowledged his own and many faculty members' disagreement with Professor Yoo's legal advice. And the dean argued that academic freedom and due process justly constrained what the school could and should do in response. So the applicable rules were the university rules governing faculty conduct. And the dean said, under his interpretation, that only if you were convicted of a crime which, quote, clearly demonstrates unfitness to continue as a member of the faculty, end quote, would the school initiate a process that could remove you as a professor. The possibility of the university doing so was foreclosed when the Justice Department finished its investigation of Yu in 2010 and concluded that he hadn't breached any ethical duties that would warrant censure by the Department of Justice or a referral by the department to the state bar for disciplinary proceedings. So that was the end of that. Nevertheless, the intensity of the debate after this dissipated, but there was discomfort and disquiet lingered about what this episode means for the school's collective identity. And so these are the questions that memory studies address and which the Botero, the Berkeley Boteros, as I call them, engage. So what are the Boteros? Fernando Botero is a world-famous artist. Those of you who've been to Barcelona may recognize this famous sculpture there. And he's known for his this iconic use of voluminous figures as the cat figure sculpture there is depicts. But he's also done political art in the past, and topics included of his country in Colombia. And when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, he became riveted by the U.S. torture program and decided that he wanted to respond through his art. And so what he says, and I'll quote, "For months I felt this desire to say something because I thought it was an enormous violation of human rights. The United States has been a model of compassion and human rights. That this could happen in a prison administered by the Americans was a shock," end quote. So over the next 14 months, Botero worked kind of nonstop, and he created over 80 paintings and sketches that made up what is called the Abu Ghraib series. And so the pictures and sketches, each one is called Abu Ghraib, and then they're numbered sequentially. So what did they look like? Here are some images from the series. So Botero talks about what he was trying to do, and he says he wasn't trying actually to represent torture. He wasn't trying to give us a new interpretation of the photos. We already had the photos. What he wanted to do through his art is interpret the experience of the victims. Now, what doesn't come through in the slides are the scale of many of these paintings. So some of these here actually are on display at the law school. And you have to imagine that these are, they're, you know, meters, they're several square meters that would take up, you know, almost half of that wall there. So when they hang, they just dominate the scene, and they sort of capture, you're sort of swallowed up in the size of the paintings. And so he talks explicitly about using this to create a moral narrative about the descent of the United States. And he commented that he painted so the world would not forget about the violence in Abu Ghraib. And his last quote is, "People would forget about Guernica if it were it not for Picasso's masterpiece. Art is a permanent accusation." So how did those paintings then actually, some of them, come to Berkeley? Initially, there was only a single short exhibition of the work in the United States in 2006. Now, the law school dean at the time, I mentioned Chris Edley, helped to bring the series to the university for an exhibit the next year. And they were actually exhibited, the university museum space was not available, so they converted one of the reading rooms in the library, our central library in the center of campus, was given over to the exhibition. After the school closed, Botero decided about 6 months later to donate the entire collection, which was valued at $15 million, to the university art museum. And so reportedly the art museum, it came back, there was a further exhibition in the museum, and then the question was, what happens to these paintings? Initially, the art museum said, well, they just go back in the collection. And the law school dean said, no, that's not right. These need to be here. They need to be visible. The law school will take a few so that they can be on permanent display. We're a public law school. The building is open to the public. It would serve, it would provide people access. So we have four large canvases And they've been there since 2012. And they hang in a central corridor just outside the dean's offices. So if you're going to, anyone who's doing business, going to the dean or going through a major thoroughfare in the library is going to be confronted with these. And in fact, that is the point of the confrontational art, to remember. Now, the fate of the paintings is actually now in question, and they may soon be taken down because we have a new law school dean, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, who came last year. And in response to complaints from faculty, from students, from staff, from alumni, from donors, he's considering taking them down. And you can imagine that there are strong feelings on both sides of this debate. And I think the potential removal of the paintings raises questions then, has causes us to revisit why they're there at all and what their symbolic value is. And I've been thinking about this and have turned to memory studies for a conceptual framework to help think about these questions. So Maurice Habwats, the French sociologist, first developed a theory of collective memory. There's some problems with this, happy to talk in Q&A, but the critical insight for this discussion is that memories are not discovered as intact or found object, but they're socially constructed. And he applies that to collective histories. He says that these memories are stored and interpreted by social institutions. And I find this helpful to think about the paintings as works of institutional or public memory. Sometimes I'll refer to them as sites, memory sites, where memory is stored. Because this allows us to think about their representational work in greater complexity and allows us to think about what should the institution represent about its association with the torture memos, and are the paintings the right way to do it. Now, because public memory is constructed, it's also contested. And the paintings carry multiple layers of meaning, some of which are more accessible than others. And the question of one's perspective on the canvases becomes critical. So what I want to do with the remaining time is I want to sketch three interpretive frames for us to understand the paintings. Each is progressively narrower in scope. And I want to unpack the context that lets us bring these various meanings into focus. So, the first frame is what I'm calling the moral narrative of the paintings. Here the Boteros operate as works of public memory in terms of a universal story about the relationship of law to the torture memos, and more broadly the rule of law. So Dean Edley's public statements about why he brought the Boteros to the law school expressly linked the prisoner abuse as symbolizing the human horror that comes from abandoning rule of law in wartime. Edley wrote that the paintings depict, quote, law that has failed. It has failed to protect, and it's failed to teach the basic morality that underlies human rights. To me, as a lawyer, the images show what happens in the moral void created when we have no law. It's interesting that despite the traditional resistance of university administrators to take sides in political debates, that here Edley breaks with that convention. And he brings the law school into that debate about whether the detention and interrogation program was legal and effective. At the same time, he tries to maintain this division between law on the one hand and morality on the other. But he does more here. By 2012, the images could also be read as a tribute to the failure of law to address its own past errors. Edley linked the Botero exhibit to his disappointment by the decision of President Obama to initiate a thorough investigation of the CIA detention and interrogation program and the individuals who were involved in it. An investigation would have enabled the nation to debate the morality of the decisions made in light of a full record and so learn from the past. Right? That should be familiar narrative in terms of Nuremberg. Right? That's one of the lessons, common lessons from Nuremberg. Edley argued that art provokes the necessary social deliberation in the absence of those legal proceedings. So I'll read from a quote. "Because we have not applied the rule of law to the full extent, I believe we should have. Therefore, how can we be sure that we will remember? How can we be sure that we will continue to debate what is right and wrong? I believe the answer lies in part in art. This is what Señor Botero has done for us. This is what he's done for my university and my law school, and I will be eternally grateful." So the moral narrative works powerfully because of where the art hangs. Edley wanted to display the art in the law school. Right? Their location emphasizes the association of the painting with law's failure to protect. And so the paintings stand as instruction to law students and the public who see it in a law school, that law schools need to think about the what they're teaching. Law students need to think about the consequences of their legal advice. And it gives the Boteros a meaning that they would not have, did not have, when they were displayed in a museum or in a gallery. Now I want to turn to the second interpretive frame. Okay. The second interpretive frame. This one is specific to the institutional politics of the universities. Now, here I think the exhibition works as the external representation of the political, legal, and ultimately the moral balancing that the university engaged in as it negotiated between demands to censure Professor Yu for his legal work as a government lawyer and to uphold the university's principles of due process. The exhibition serves as a communicative act of moral repudiation of Yu's legal contribution, while at the same time observing the university's rules against faculty censure. Now, none of the dean's statements that accompany the exhibit mention Yu by name. So to understand why the paintings communicate this dual message, we need to understand how the calls for condemning Professor Yu were addressed by the university. So for years, as I said, the school had been criticized for its failure to distance itself from Professor Yu and his work for the Bush administration. And that included many inside the law school, included faculty who believed the university should not have taken disciplinary actions, yet at the same time felt that the law school and the university had not done enough to publicly distance itself from Yu as a principal author of the memos. So hosting the Boteros allowed the art to speak as a rebuke, not just of torture, but the torture memos and the lawyers who wrote them in ways that the institution otherwise was not able to express and not able to verbalize. At the same time, the law school and university rightly defended academic freedom principles and the employment rights of its university faculty members. The faculty conduct policies protect politically unpopular professors from sanctions for their views or activities, except in very narrow circumstances. And many, and likely most, Berkeley Law faculty supported that rule and its application in the case of Professor Yu. So in many informal conversations over the years, I can scarcely remember any faculty member who disagreed with this content-neutral rule of protection for faculty conduct. And I don't remember anyone, including myself, who advocated that these protections should not apply to Professor Yu. You have to remember that this was during the wartime political climate. We were in Afghanistan and Iraq. There was a fear that pushing to entangle the university in administration in judgments about the acceptability of what faculty members said and did outside of their job duties would be used against faculty members who were advocating against the war. Moreover, the university didn't have any jurisdiction to adjudicate whether the torture memo authors had broken any laws. That was the job of the federal government, to investigate and prosecute if their legal counsel violated criminal statutes. And if there were any ethical violations, that was the Department of Justice or the State Bar Associations. right, which we saw was not going to go forward. So public demands that the law school remove you had no legal basis formally, and instead were then grounded in principally a moral argument that, in light of his work on the memos, that Professor Yu was unfit to maintain his academic appointment. And Dean Edley refused to yield to critics on this point. In fact, he went out of his way to defend Yu as a faculty member. And over time, as more information came out about the program, his appointment came increasingly under fire. And there was actually an editorial from the editorial board of the New York Times questioning why he was still employed. Nevertheless, Edley held firm. So inside the law school, faculty members' attitudes towards the torture memos was largely negative, I would say. And many of us wrote articles, organized conferences, gave speeches that challenged the legal reasoning of the torture memos and their impacts. And for some, these counter-torture memo activities felt unsatisfying and inadequate as a way to respond to John Yu's impact on the school's reputation. So faculty members exercised their rights to academic freedom in criticizing the torture program, but the institution remained silent. So when Dean Edley announced the display of a few of the Boteros at the law school as his initiative, the paintings communicated a strong institutional counter-torture response. And undoubtedly, some see the paintings simply as a condemnation of you as a faculty member, but I think that's too simple. I think the law school's adherence to its rules of faculty conduct meant that you was not going to be sanctioned. And that circumscribed, but it did not extinguish the school's ability to respond to the moral challenge that you's faculty membership presented to the institution's values. So as Edley explained, law and morality differ. With its unique rules of argumentation and evidence, law can't adequately address all the problems that society confronts, but the Boteros communicated a more nuanced response than law was able to convey. So the inability of law to remonstrate lawyers for justifying torture created the moral problem that the exhibition sought to address. So let me put it slightly differently. If Professor Yu had been sanctioned for his work as a government lawyer, the law school's exhibition of the Boteros would have communicated that universal message that torture is a symptom of the breakdown of the rule of law, but their display would not have needed to remind the audience, as Edley made clear, that the nation still needed to investigate the legal underpinnings of the war on terror. So that in the absence of legal accountability, the law school's stated principled response to you failed to acknowledge the moral harm that the institution incurred. This additional context imbues these canvases with symbolic meaning. They acknowledge that you is a full member of the community. At the same time, they acknowledge that his presence does not mean the law school condones his work on the memos. The painting symbolically performed the law school's public commitment to two values that are in tension. Defense of the university as a site where controversial ideas and free debate are encouraged, and its public repudiation of torture and lawyers who justify its use. Now, the final interpretive frame examines the relationship between the public memory and institutional identity as communicated by the school, and the role of the faculty in shaping this communication. Those of you here who are faculty members and future faculty members, this is an invitation to think about how we exercise our agency and what can circumscribe that our use of it. The interplay between internal faculty discussions surrounding the torture memos and the public memory the dean promoted through the Botero exhibit suggests that academic norms of collegiality powerfully shaped the public-facing communication of the law school. So you returned to the law school when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, and the calls from the public and students to fire Professor Yu linked you state torture and Berkeley in ways that directly implicated the identity of the law school and the university. And I argue directly confronted faculty with the uncomfortable question of how they should respond. Now, collectively, the faculty behaved consistent with the dean's rejection of university sanction of year. Faculty members did not issue any public statements as a collective, either defending or condemning you. Faculty maintenance of collegiality contributed to an environment which silenced any collective legal or moral judgments about you for his work on the memos, right? We are a law faculty of lawyers. There could have been an internal assessment offering our own legal views of it. None was forthcoming. Now, this prevented potentially divisive debate within the faculty, and it maintained a particular kind of faculty politics. At the same time, it also left the dean to represent the faculty on this issue, and he did so without the cost or the benefit of a formal faculty deliberation. Now, whatever the cost would have been to morale, and I don't want to minimize it, there might have been cost, significant cost to doing so, the faculty silence shaped the school's institutional identity in response to this moral challenge that Yu's presence provoked. And it enabled the dean to act unilaterally to promote the image that he wanted. So I want to unpack how collegiality restrained discourse, since the association of the law school with the memo seemed to require a response. So law schools, like the legal profession, place a high value on civil collegial discourse. In keeping with the ideals of the university as an incubator and nurturer of intellectual inquiry and knowledge generation, faculty regularly debate ideas and exchange views over contentious interpretations of law and policy. But there are norms that bound this collegial discourse. So it's fine to disagree vigorously with the scholarly views of a fellow faculty member, but ad hominem attacks are clearly out of bounds. Now, Edley framed Yu's controversial legal advice in terms of his role as a government lawyer. That framing placed Yu's legal opinion outside the bounds for formal sanction by the school. Right? The Bush administration had defended the legality of the program, and we don't have a definitive legal judgment to contradict the administration's interpretation, nor Professor Yu's and others' continued defense of the memos. So there wasn't then, and I don't think there is now, a public consensus on the morality of the conduct of several key legal and political protagonists and their roles. And so without a definitive conclusion on legality, where was the line between legal and illegal conduct, and how could the faculty as an institutional collective be justified in offering any opinion? So Edley relied on these university rules of faculty conduct to make any employment consequence to you for the opinions contingent on a criminal conviction. So the dean demarcated acceptable faculty discourse. He postponed any relevance of faculty views on the legal or moral consequences of Yu's work while in government service, until external authorities issued a legal determination of the consequences. Faculty members voicing opinions on the matter were not commenting on authoritative judgments, but rather offering their own views on the conduct of another faculty member that were outside of that member's academic duties. And that could come uncomfortably close to crossing the line of collegiality. So in effect, Edley's framing collapsed moral questions into legal ones, which the law school faculty was in no position to adjudicate. The law school, as a formal matter, had externalized responsibility to such judgments, right? To the DOJ, to a state bar. Unlike debates within universities over their associations with controversial figures who are long gone, use presence on the faculty and tangled the past into the present in ways that proved impossible to segregate. So let me put it slightly differently. If fairness required the school to resist public calls for youth censure, what legitimate purpose could open faculty discussion of their colleagues' government service produce? Yet to those outside the law school, the school's defense of youth's position made no sense. The law school was home to one of the legal architects of the War on Terror, which had led the United States to an unprecedented rebuke of international law, contributed to acts of torture, and damaged U.S. credibility as a champion of democratic values. Yet the school had nothing to say about what Yu's presence provoked for the law school's identity as a leading public law school. So even if the university had no grounds for his removal, faculty could have expressed their views about the morality and the optics of having a senior faculty member, one of the lawyers who approved torture techniques, and immunized state agents from criminal prosecutions. But to do so risked accusations of scapegoating a government attorney for carrying out his job, or illegitimately seeking to make a colleague's extramural conduct relevant to their fitness to serve as a faculty member. Instead, faculty public discourse centered on organized academic gatherings, on the War on Terror, and at these, no one spoke directly to the questions that the protesters were raising about the possibility and need for disciplinary sanctions or other measures that the university could pursue against Professor Yu. The restraining powers of self-censorship is another property of collegiality, right? What we keep, what we withhold. And this operated to prevent faculty not only from criticizing Yu directly for his work in the government, it also silenced the faculty from debating whether Yu's association with the law school called upon the institution to take any action other than defending his employment rights. This left the faculty outside of any process to consider what, if anything, the institution should communicate about the apparent contradiction between the law school's rule of law values and its association with their perversion. Now, it's likely that faculty held a range of views on this topic, and it's not possible to know what the outcome of that deliberation would have been, or its impact on faculty morale. The point is, without a formal process of consultation, the dean was left to construct the school's response to these critiques. So the question is, should the paintings stay or should they go? The law school is about to reconsider whether they stay. If I want to return in my concluding moments to think about, so how does this analytic frame of memory aid in thinking about how we might answer that question? It's clear from talking to students today in the building and faculty that for many, these paintings just no longer make sense. That somehow the debates about torture belong to another time. Sometimes the images are upsetting, or this type of art is not befitting the grandeur of a law school, or that the art just singles out a faculty member, or they're just on aesthetic matters, this is just bad art, right? But I think that the paintings, like all sites of memory, need, what this reminds me, they need to be stoked in order to keep their meaning alive. If we consider them as aesthetics, I think we're just going to we'll talk past each other. If we consider them as what meaning do they hold, one of the things is this is provokes a reconsideration of what they mean and how we curate that meaning. And so meaning, there's a dynamic interaction between viewer and object that's mediated by the context in which the viewing takes place. And that context changes over time. Like we're now in 2019, we're not in 2004 or 2008 or 2010. And so that helps explain why at certain times the Boteros have been more controversial than at other times, and why we need to think about how we can, if they're to be kept, how we can reactivate the memory in order for the paintings to have their communicative power. The second point is that when we pose the question about whether to erect or remove sites of memory, we reduce the moral complexity of the decision. Rather than seeing the paintings as proxies for sentiments about US detention and interrogation program, interpreting them as the construction of public memory offers a more complex understanding of their communicative power. So an alternative framing is to ask how, not whether, but how the school should acknowledge its unique relationship to the torture memos. And I think this begins to capture the collective social meanings of this relationship that have circulated within the law school and more broadly. It provides a context in which we can acknowledge that the paintings commemorate more than just the breakdown of the rule of law. It provides a vocabulary to discuss what the Boteros mean to the community, what values they symbolize, and how best to preserve these memories. So my argument is that employing public memory as a framework shifts the debate from a focus on seeing the Boteros as a normative judgment about Yu's personal involvement in the memos to acknowledging that the controversy surrounding his role raises questions of institutional identity. And underlying both sides of this argument is about the propriety of displaying the Boteros because they communicate a repudiation of the torture memos is Yu's association with the paintings. And we can't escape that. And so what is lost is an appreciation of the institutional practices that helped produce the public memory of the paintings. The law school defended the propriety of Yu to serve on the faculty based on the institution's adherence to rule of law. In the Botero exhibit, the dean performatively joined that contradiction between the school's simultaneous embrace of Yu as a faculty member and moral repudiation of the harms to which his legal advice as a government attorney contributed. So that ambiguity that the art is capable of holding, I think, is actually helpful to the community in this regard. Their mnemonic work functions at the level both of the universal and at the level of the institution. And the universal message of the Boteros is as urgent today as it was when the artist created the paintings. The international project of the proliferation of human rights is under assault, and 9/11 was a decisive inflection point in this regard. The public memory of the Berkeley Boteros transcends the controversy of one faculty member, and the importance of the works justifies their placement at the law school. And yet the institution cannot escape its association with one of the primary creators of this post 9/11 infrastructure. Displaying the paintings enables the school to communicate its institutional commitment at the same time that it is to rule of law, at the same time it is actually practicing that in this ambiguous way. So I think that the Boteros imperfectly resolve the moral challenge to the school's institutional identity that its association with the torture memos provokes. As a final note, I want to point out that there are multiple ways to acknowledge past histories, and the law school could take other measures instead of or in addition to the Boteros to mark this association. For example, it could include the teaching of the torture memos in the law school curriculum. It could have an annual public lecture on torture and rule of law, or even, God forbid, require international law as a graduation requirement, right? There are other things the institution can do. But the point is that the institutions have a responsibility to curate their own identities, and healthy institutions can't escape past associations that sit uncomfortably with their present values. And this is particularly true in settings committed to open debate and the rule of law. The Berkeley case suggests that the school should harness these mnemonic representations in service of civic engagement, namely how law schools, universities, and society remember, embody, and communicate their highest values. So thank you for your time, and look forward to questions.